Hello and welcome to MOAS. Last time we looked at civil society in action and the kinds of projects and organizations operating across Europe. Join us as we continue our exploration into the people and organizations who are helping refugees and migrants. We'll look at the opportunities and difficulties they've faced setting up. Let's begin by transporting you to Canada. Canada operates two systems of accepting refugees and migrants: government-assisted and private sponsorship. Families, community groups, and civil society organizations like churches find private sponsorship a popular route for bringing groups of refugees and family members to Canada. Of the over 40,000 Syrian refugees resettled in Canada since November 2015, over 14,000 of them were privately sponsored. Janet Dench is executive director of the umbrella organization, the Canadian Council for Refugees. CCR represents its many members working to resettle refugees and migrants. She tells us more.
Well, our membership is very varied. We have organizations that are multi-million dollar budget organizations that receive funding from different levels of government to offer settlement services. But we also have really volunteer organizations that spring up, in particular communities. We have also organizations such as church-based organizations that have national networks where they're connecting with people in their congregations across Canada. So there's lots of different ways in which people are connected to the communities. But I think that your question is good in focusing on the grassroots and the ways in which the communities are involved, because that's, in our experience, that's really where things are happening in a positive way, both for the communities and for refugees that are being received, because that's where people can get involved and can make a difference.
In Canada, what percentage of refugees are government-assisted and privately sponsored?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and there's not a simple answer for the last few years because the numbers have been going up and down. For our organization, as a matter of principle, we are very keen that the number of government-assisted refugees always be equal to or preferably more than the numbers of privately sponsored refugees, because we think it's important that the government really take on its responsibilities on behalf of all Canadians and not offload its responsibilities towards refugees onto the private citizens. In this current year, that is not applying. There's 16,000 privately sponsored refugees in the target and only 7,500 government-assisted refugees. And we have complained about that because it does send the message that the government is stepping back and letting citizens do more, which violates the principle of additionality, which is that what citizens do should be over and above what the government does. The reason that they've got those numbers higher for private sponsorship is that there's a big backlog. So there's a lot of frustration among private sponsors in Canada who have put in their applications, and they're waiting a very long time before the refugees that they've sponsored come to Canada. So the government decided that they wanted to give priority to processing those private sponsorship applications, and they weren't willing to increase the overall target for resettled refugees above 25,000.
Setting up a civil society organization isn't easy, and it can be riddled with issues. One such project was the African Media Association based in Malta. Its founder, David Milner, joined up with Ahmed, a Somali migrant and journalist looking to restart his career. Its aim was to find a way to broadcast news to the African migrant communities in Malta. The project suffered from problems securing funding and recording space, but it hasn't stopped David helping migrants.
The big problem we had was we thought when we applied for the funding, which was good, useful funding, that we would be able to take some money to buy some recording equipment, and we were told no, this funding specifically is for operating costs, and we had nothing in there to buy equipment. We also went to a number of radio stations, including one, Campus FM, and others, RTV, the community radio station, and no one was willing to give any recording time. Even we begged half an hour a week when the studio's not being used, And we had no equipment. We had a room which was full of echoes and traffic, and we could not find anyone willing to support us for this. So we did make a few radio broadcasts. Ahmed was not happy with the quality, but we put six out. But we focused more on other aspects of media and communication. We set up a YouTube channel. We were making videos, interviews with government ministers or with migrants or any other things which were relevant at the time. And we were putting a lot of written material out as well, both in English, which I was generally writing, and in Somali language, which Ahmed was writing. And sometimes even he would make a video and explain to me, please write the English text that should be seen to the side of the video. So this was how we were operating. What surprised us was how quickly we took an audience from Facebook in particular. We set up an African Media Association Malta Facebook page. And I think by the end of the 12-month project, we had 3,000 plus likes on that page. And all the time, we were just watching this number roll. So people were really connecting with us through that and watching. So we don't have accurate figures as to who listens or who reads, but I think the fact we had 3,000 people already on Facebook liking the page, and quite a few of the Facebook items we posted, including videos, were shared many times. So we were really hitting that community. Also, of course, we had the opposing community, who don't like anyone on the street who's a migrant, especially if you have a black face. We have to remember, in Malta, most of us probably are migrants because we come from many countries. But if you have a black face, it's different. You're very much the minority in number, but you're the ones that show up and people can see. So there's a small proportion of the Maltese community who are completely against any integration, any migrants being here at all.
In its wake, you set up the Migrant Skills Register with Skilled Migrant website. What does this do and why?
We came to the end of the first project in September 2015, and we have applied for some funds we didn't get, but we applied to the Malta Council for Voluntary Sector. They're offering up to 3,000 for what's called SIS funding, small initiative scheme, I think it stands for. And we were successful. We got funding for that, but you know, we had to make a project. So I was looking at this thinking, what is the greatest need for the migrants here? You know, they have many needs, but the greatest one is to get work. And again, the system in Malta is not conducive to them finding work. So there are a lot of asylum seekers who are still going through the asylum seeking process, or who have been rejected once or twice. They are not permitted to register for work with ETC Jobs Plus. So the government system is excluding this minority, who are the most disadvantaged. The migrants who've come through, they have refugee status, they have subsidiary protection. They can register, but they need a lot of support. It's very difficult for them to just come in and be offered a job. They go along to an interview, they're not prepared for it, you know, if they can get an interview. And you know, we know a lot of employers just don't give the possibilities to migrants. So we thought what we need to do is to set up a project. We call it the pilot project because we've learned a lot from it, and it was very small seed funding. And the concept was to get them to register. It's a little bit like a CV online. It's not so professional. But over the 12 months of the project, which actually officially ended, the funding finished in January, we had more than 100 migrants apply, put their information, and we've developed a system where we take them through a process, because it's not enough just to take their details. So we interview everyone. So we have a team of people interviewing them, assessing their language skills and other skills, And there's a lot of cultural differences as well with work. So we have one Somali, it's actually our vice president. He intervenes before they go off to a job interview, for example. So we had to also, obviously, we contact employers, and we have a relatively small number of employers, but we're looking for more. And they are telling us their needs, and we are trying to filter. We're working to filter the list of people to try and provide them the people that they need most. So if somebody needs to be able to read and write English and have a driving license, for example, we put those filters in and see who comes out, and there might be a small number that satisfy that requirement. It is a big problem when they don't speak English, because you need to communicate in work. But there's also many other skills of preparing people for work in another culture, in another continent. We're trying also to guide the applicants towards all the things that they need to do, whether it's being prompt to dress smartly for an interview. You know, there's 1,001 little things, but we need to guide them. They're not ready in every case just to go and work in a Maltese situation.
What areas of employment are you finding for migrants?
What we're trying to do is to find out what skills they have, because there are a lot of untapped skills. And it's very common when they're really short of money, they're at the bottom of the pile, so to speak, in society. They will take the first job. So they could be a scientist, they could be an IT specialist, they could be a doctor. But if all they can do is to get paid for sweeping the kitchen floor, they'll sweep the kitchen floor. So this is another element of this that we're saying to them, let's be honest, don't apply for what you think you'll get a job for, like cleaning. Tell us what your real skills are, and then we'll try and match them with an employer who needs them. Malta is in a fortunate position of having very low unemployment. It's below 5%. It's very, very good here. And Malta is thriving as a business centre at the moment, and employers are looking for more skilled people. So we're really open to any area. Malta has big needs for construction, for the hospitality industry, bars, restaurants, obviously cleaning for, and various other skills. We've put people into welding jobs. We're just open to what employers want, and then we see who fits the bill. What we need, as I say, are more employers to come forward. But even the employers, we can't just send the migrants that we filtered along. We have to brief the employers so that we have the same expectations from the potential employer and the potential employee, because often the expectations are different. And quite a few of the employers are really not looking to pay enough money for the migrants to live. They're coming because they think this is a cheap source of labour. And whilst they don't get paid much, you know, we have to have fairness as well. You know, we've had people go to jobs, they were told they were going to earn €6 an hour, and when they got there, they were told, no, it's not that, and they didn't have enough just to feed the family, pay the rent. So we have to try to balance everything.
Giving a voice to the migrant community is vital. It helps them get their stories heard. That's the view of Farah Abdullahi Abdi, Somali trans woman, blogger, public speaker, and activist. She spent 4 years in Malta struggling with social exclusion. Although she didn't set up a civil society organization, Malta's NGOs made her feel welcome. And she made sure her time here wasn't wasted.
In the 4 years, I was blessed enough or privileged enough to do a lot. I had a blog with one of the largest papers on the island. I was able to publish a book that ended up launching in other countries. I started doing public speaking, whereby I spoke at the European Parliament, the United Nations, several other public events across Europe and the world. So pretty much I did a lot of activism. Over the last 4 years, I was very proud that I was able to achieve some of my biggest dreams, especially in a place whereby I didn't feel comfortable, and I didn't feel welcome, and I didn't feel accepted.
How did you start writing a blog?
I basically approached the editor, one of the editors of Malta Today, and I convince them to give me a space on their website to be able to tell about refugee stories, because most of the time what was happening was that other people were speaking about our stories and they did not know exactly what they were talking about. So I was like, give me the opportunity to tell our stories from ourselves directly and the issues that we're facing. And yeah, we were able to develop a community around that, and we were able to change some of the policies, some of the racist and xenophobic policies that were in place. For example, there's a story that I did about how difficult it was for refugees to get residence cards in Malta after getting international protection. The Home Office in Malta made it pretty much impossible for refugees to get identity cards. And that was going on for the last 3 years. And when I did the story, it was very shameful that in a European country, people have to sleep outside a government office to be able to get identification. So we were able to change make the government give us an office that would serve us from Monday to Friday, as opposed to only Friday before.
You wrote your book, Never Arrive. How did writing about your experiences help you?
I think the book was cathartic for me because it gave me like a voice to be able to, at a time when I felt like I didn't have a voice, sort of. And it was like my diary to vent out, because as I'm saying, some of my most frustrated years were not lived in Libya, were not lived in Kenya. They were lived in a European country, Malta. So Never Arrive was my diary through the 4 years of, I think this is extreme, but torture. Torture is not the word, it's too extreme, but that's how I felt at the time.
Civil society organizations are driven to help out of responsibility and compassion for the refugees affected. However, if larger aid charities are slow to respond, they face steep learning curves. That's what happened to UK-based Help Refugees when they arrived in the Calais refugee camp back in August 2015. They went from being another helping hand to becoming the umbrella administrator of the camp, feeding, sheltering, and supporting its diverse population of 10,000. Nico Stevens is a co-founder heading up Help Refugees projects.
I've spent a lot of time in sub-Saharan Africa, and to be perfectly honest, when I first went to the Calais camp, I really felt like I was stepping into another continent. There were no tents, there was no water. At the time, people were saying there was a cholera problem. Distributing any form of aid was so incredibly difficult because people were in such need. It was a really difficult thing to see, and totally unbelievable that we were 26 kilometres from England. At the same time, I was meeting the most incredible people who really did not deserve to live in such conditions. You know, I met a poet from Sudan who was more articulate than I could ever be. I met a woman who spoke perfect English, was educated higher than I was, guiding her entire family from Iran to safety and seeking a life where they could live in peace. So it was a really complex first impressions, I would say. You know, people living in just the most utterly awful conditions, but also that had such spirit inside them and such hope.
What kinds of activities have you brought to the camp?
We started by renting a warehouse. That was our kind of first port of call. We started by learning logistics and storage and haulage. And obviously with that comes NFI and distribution. We very quickly, as soon as we started working in the camps, collectively were working with the community themselves and learnt that the community in the camps did not want line distributions. It was an undignified way of receiving aid. So we created distribution points, worked with different communities to make sure that the NFI provision happened. We also started building shelter, as I said. So building infrastructure, women and children's services, food. Something that we're really proud of was working with a group called Calais Kitchens, who realised that with a hugely different demographic in the camp, different people had different needs in terms of food, and there were different groups cooking together. Some were small groups, a group of four friends. Some were, you know, groups of 30 that would cook together. And food is such an important part of culture. So we worked with the communities to make sure that they received dry food packs in the kind of food that they wanted. So for instance, Eritreans really like pasta, whereas Afghans really like rice. So that was a really big part of what we do, was working with the different cultures and the different groups to make sure that they received aid in a dignified way.
How important has it been to conduct census on the residents of the camp? And can you tell me a bit more about the numbers and demographics of the people you were coming into contact with?
So we conducted the first census during the first eviction of the south bit of the camp in February 2016. And this was the first time that any reliable and accurate data was collected on the camp's population. Until that point, there were only estimates by the French authorities, which were really grossly underestimated the number of residents in the camp. And that's why we sought to conduct our own census, because we were appalled at the numbers that the authorities were putting out there, because we knew that they were at some points double. Something that was really important that came out of that first census after the first eviction of the camp is that we found that 129 unaccompanied minors from the camp had gone unaccounted for. And having these kind of numbers has been absolutely invaluable for advocacy, providing the numbers of people living in such conditions that were previously ignored by authorities has been used for evidence in legal battles, and gives us a legitimacy when we're talking about the conditions. The census was also important for all different kinds of reasons. We were able to identify the changing demographics, the changing needs, adapt our distribution to adapt the numbers and the type of food that we were making. In September of 2016, we announced that there were 10,000 people living in the camp, and this was just ahead of the final eviction. This was a really important number because it brought to light the sheer amount of people that were living there, and the authorities were very much trying to deny that in their media. So I suppose most importantly for us, we were able to identify the number of unaccompanied children, and that has led us to legitimately fight for their rights.
Food doesn't just nourish. It can be a way to create healthy and inclusive society, bridging cultures and experiences. That's what inspired La Rachot, a French organization on wheels that's sharing its culinary skills with refugees. Their first missions were in La Lignea camp in northern France. It's been a great way to connect local people with refugees without a common language. Alix Gerbet is one of its 10 founders.
Well, when we decided that we wanted to create Le Réchaud and to start the adventure, we had ambitions. We had an idea of what we wanted to do. And we all work, most of us work in the cooking environment, and we already do cooking classes. So we knew, Vanessa knew, Elodie knew, I, as far as I'm concerned, work also for a cooking class firm. So I know also that, well, leading cooking workshops brings people together and makes people work together. And this is really what we wanted to do. And when we arrived on the camps, we had no idea of what would happen. We didn't know if the magic would just work or if people wouldn't be welcoming. And what we found is an amazing place where we found amazing people, where at the beginning we taught French recipes, and then as the days were going on, well, the people on the camp, who were mostly Kurdish at the beginning, started to, well, choose the recipes, to tell us about their memories, about what they used to cook, about how they liked their dishes to be prepared, and we spent some amazing days, and somehow the word refugee disappeared, and it became Saman that we met and Karwan that we met and all those friendly faces, which are people, well, mostly like us, who just didn't have the luck to be born on the good side of the world, but who are mostly like people are like us. So it was really amazing, and it was full of love and of understanding. And even if though they didn't speak French, we could sometimes speak in English with them. But most of the time, we didn't even need to speak. We were just standing here for hours, cooking together, preparing the meals that we were going to have together. And then, which is really important, and this is what Le Réchaud is, it was also to have the meal together. Once it was cooked with the local people, with the refugees, with us, everybody sat and ate together. And so it was like magic, really.
How many refugees are you feeding per day?
Well, the results of at the beginning, with when we decided to create Le Réchaud, the idea was to build a food truck, to buy a food truck, and to go and realize some missions on some refugee camps. Our first mission took part from August the 17th to the 3rd of September in 2016. So we spent 3 weeks on a camp near Dunkerque, which is called La Linière, which is a camp that was built by the mayor of the city, that is called Grande Sainte. And it was the only camp in Europe, and well, in France, which was to the European norms. So it was quite a unique camp, and that's where we did our first mission. During those 3 weeks of mission, 10,500 meals were served in 3 weeks. We led 20 cooking workshops with migrants and volunteers, and among those, 4 workshops were only for women, and 2 workshops were hosted by star chefs, French star chefs, and something like 60 volunteers helped us overall. So it would be like 10,500 meals, which makes something like 300 and 500 meals a day.
What kinds of training do you provide?
What we do is really to use the kitchen and the cooking as a way to bring life again on those camps. So training would be that every day on those camps, it's mostly a question of survival. Like people who are in France, they are and on those camps, they usually want to go to the UK or not to stay in France. So each night they try to pass. And if they don't succeed, they come back and they're during the day, they have, well, mostly nothing to do. With Le Réchaud, we had a timetable which was really precise and was the same every day. So it was a way to instilling again a rhythm and a day-to-day life, which is not the usually, which doesn't happen on the camps. And while cooking is also about discipline, it's about respecting the one that is cooking with you. It's also about sharing. It was also about like bringing again a link between the local populations who were helping us and about the refugees. So it was about bonding again. And it was also, the thing is that on those camps, there are also people who are already trained to cooking. And we know that there are some, there are many jobs that are available in France for this, for in the cooking and the restoration universe. So it was also about putting in touch the chefs that we met and that were supporting our action with the refugees that are already on the camp and that have the qualifications to find and to like seek for a job in France. So it's not mostly training, but it's really about communicating and putting in touch people with qualification and people with job offers.
And how does it make you feel to be doing this?
It makes me feel human. It makes me feel it's good for the soul, it's good for the heart, it's good for the people. It's amazing to see how much good energy comes out of a project like this and how we do it because we feel that what happened on the camps is not like, doesn't look like how we would like to welcome those people. And at the beginning, it's something that we do because we want to heal this situation that we don't like. But now that it has been a year, we also are really conscious about the fact that it also helps us in our day-to-day life. It's really fulfilling to make this and to realize that everything is achievable. That if you have the energy and if you have the good people around you and that you have the feeling that what you do is right, then nothing can stop you. And this is it makes you confident and ambitious about the future and about human after all. So it's as good for us as it is good for the people who we cook with on the camps, I think.
Now, for most of us here in the Northern Hemisphere, we're at the peak of summer, and what better way to enjoy it than to have a barbecue? But how do you feel about one with a twist? Forget your burgers and bangers. How about a Brazilian barbecue that's raising money for good causes? Well, that's what marketing specialist Lucia Mastro Mauro has been doing for the last 9 years, and she's managed to get the support of big companies to match her fundraising. Moas has been helped by our barbecue. Here's her story.
The barbecue started many years ago, about 9 years ago, when through my career I have moved a lot. I've lived in London, I've lived in Geneva, in Zurich, in Italy, and so on. So one of the leaving do's, which was around my birthday, I organized sort of a semi-leaving slash birthday party. And having lived in London for a long time and always having a little bit of an issue with these English standard barbecues, which is basically burgers, sausages, coming from Brazil with a family that comes from the south of Brazil, the Pampas land, I've always kind of shook my head and was like, this is not really a barbecue. So I decided to, by then I was earning a little bit more, I decided to sponsor a barbecue for my friends for my birthday and as a living party. It was about 40 people that time. I borrowed a friend's garden in Camden, invited everybody, and and it was an amazing party. Everybody loved the meat. Everybody loved that they actually had real meat for the barbecue. My friend that lent me the garden, she's vegan, so we had to kind of keep the meat away from her side at the same time, serving some of the vegetarians and vegans at the party and not let anybody clash at, you know, at the sight of blood and meat.
When did you decide to use the barbecue as a fundraiser?
I used to fly to London every so often to see friends or for business reasons, for school as well. I was still doing some exams. And my friends were like, oh, can you do a barbecue this year again? And I'm like, you know, guys, it costs quite a bit of money to actually buy meat to a lot of people. We often, you know, will buy good steaks. So I feel a little bit uneasy about feeding you all for no reason. And they were like, well, but it will give you the money. We'll give you all the money that you need for the barbecue. We just need you to organize. And I'm like, still, it doesn't feel right. So after a few, side conversations, I said to them, what if we still do the barbecue? You guys still put in money, but rather than giving me the money, we fundraise for a cause or a charity or something. I don't really care. But as long as it's worthy of your money, of our effort, we do some due diligence to ensure it goes to a charity that is going to make use of that money. And it's going to be kind of actually applied to a cause. And everybody was like, yeah, sure, no problem. We like the idea. And the following year, I flew in from Switzerland to kind of organize it, borrowed again a friend's garden. And I think we had about 50, 60 people that year. And since then, we've been kind of growing the amount of people that come to the barbecue. It's become a little bit of a kind of a yearly, you know, very expected to kind of attend barbecue. And every year until last year, we've kind of changed the charities that we support. So normally I will put out a I will just send an email out to everybody and say, hey guys, anybody out there would like to suggest any charities or cause, it needs to be, you know, something that we can fundraise for. Ideally, we can fundraise through Just Giving, but, you know, suggest a worthy cause and so on. So we'll get about 10 to 20 suggestions. Then we look at the ones that we might have, you know, a couple of times received, you know, suggestions twice or three times, consolidate, put up a list, normally about 10 to 15, and then I send it back with a doodle for people to vote. in an anonymous way. So we get the one that, you know, hangs higher, and as long as it's a worthy charity that people will connect with and nobody has an objection to it, we pick it. So we've done Amnesty International, War Child, Save the Rhino. Save the Rhino was rather interesting because the amount of people that thought the irony of eating cows to save rhinos that year was kind of hilarious, but people got it.
How did you end up choosing MOAS?
MOAS came up, voted last year as the highest charity. We had another charity with not a similar cause, but around the same, with projects around refugees as well, that came second. So it was very top of mind topic last year. We really thought that MOAS was like spot on, amazing. That we got people that voted on for MOAS. And as a background, I don't exactly remember how MOAS came into the list or who exactly suggested it, but it was the year before I was still working for Google, and we, as Googlers, kind of started voicing to management that there was a massive refugee crisis going on. Google has a project called Google Give, which I volunteered 20% of my time as well at times on specific projects that they had. So we were like, can Google do something about it? And at that year, Google offered $5 million to three, three charities / organizations that were looking after the refugee cause. Any donation that employees put forward, they were going to match on top of that. So I think that created a lot of also awareness amongst my friends. A lot of them are Googlers. So when we came to select the charity for voting, what I asked people is think of smaller charities that, you know, we will raise 2-3K max. So a charity that will genuinely benefit. I know the, you know, UN refugee organization is amazing, but I'm not sure they, you know, how impactful our 2-3K will be. Therefore, please suggest smaller charities. So MOAS came out of that. It was voted up by everybody. When we were about to kind of send out an email out, the friends, there's about 10 people that helped me put the barbecue together by now, because it's becoming such a big undertaking. They started kind of rumbling around. They're like, do we really need to pick another charity? And it's like, well, it's been tradition, but we don't have to. You know, it's not written in a rule book per se. There's no penalty. And I was like, why? They were like, well, you know, nobody's talking about refugees, but it's still a major issue. And I completely agree. So we made an executive decision that we would support MOAS this year again.
How do you go about getting big companies to match your funding?
So I wrote to my CEO and said, hi, Ricardo, this is what we do. This is more or less, we normally raise about £3,000. We are trying to push for a little bit higher this year. Do you think King could match? And we didn't have a charity matching program. So he talked to some people, I don't know who, and they got back to me immediately saying, yes, we will match your event, and we are working on a program as well, which is great. And then on top of that, one of my friends who works with another company, is one of her clients, she actually went up to them and said, I would like you to sponsor Lucia's barbecue because it's a worthy cause. And, you know, you guys are a great company. You have great values and so on. So they immediately said yes. So this year is the first year we had two companies matching donations, which then triples the amount, which gave us big ambitions, because next year we want to go to more companies and say, every little helps if multiple companies can match. We can maximize the impact. So and hopefully we are going to get just over £12,000 between the donations and the two companies matching.
You can find out more about the barbecue by following the links in the transcript. From food to friendship, building to belonging, civil society organizations and initiatives are filling the gaps when the conventional response is too slow. And it's clear in the current migration crisis, they've been stepping up for some time. In the next podcast, we're going to explore the theme of labels. What is a refugee? When do you become an asylum seeker? Who is a migrant? We'll find out about the different ways that governments and institutions use them, what it means for the people who are given them, how do they feel about it? Until then, you can follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom. Or you can support our rescue missions by giving whatever you can to help save lives at sea. If you like this podcast, don't forget to hit like, comment, and subscribe for more podcasts from us. From all of us here at MOAS, goodbye.